Thanks for joining us. Dr. Terry Walls teaches dentists and dental assistants about nutrition and cellular health and discusses the impact of gum disease on heart disease and stroke risk. She also presents nutritional strategies to reduce the risk of new dental cavities and increase the remineralization healing of existing cavities.
Thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. What I'll be discussing is up from the wheelchair, using intensive nutrition to defeat secondary progressive multiple sclerosis and straightened teeth. The objectives is to understand the impact of nutrition and health behaviors on chronic disease, understand the impact of nutrition health behaviors on dental health, and understand in particular the impact of omega-3 fatty acids, minerals, vitamins on tooth alignment and brain development. I have to give you my conflicts of interest. I'm doing a clinical trial with support from Direct MS Charity of Canada, DGO Incorporated, Pinnacle Life Incorporated. I own copyrights to several books and lectures, one of them being Minding My Mitochondria. I'm a lecturer and I have equity interest in TZ Press and the Walls Foundation. I also need to put out my disclaimer that the FDA has not evaluated any of the statements made in this presentation on my website or in my books, or any of them made by me. Nor are any of my statements intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease, because in the U.S., only an FDA-approved drug, diet, or device can legally make such claims. What you're about to hear today is education. So let me begin the story. When I first came to the University of Iowa, I was diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. I took Copaxone and with the intent of reducing the relapses or the episodes where I'd have worsening MS symptoms. And actually I did quite well. I had only one episode of transient weakness of my right arm. But by 2003, I needed a cane, scooter, and then a tilt-reclined wheelchair. I switched over to Novantrone and then Tysabri. Tysabri was pulled from the market, and then I went on to Salcept. And when I hit the wheelchair, that's when I went back to reading the medical literature night after night. And slowly I realized that if I was looking for the latest clinical trials, these were about drugs that I could not access. So it made far more sense for me to begin reading about things that I could access, such as vitamins and supplements. And that was the beginning of creating a list of brain nutrients and nutrients for mitochondria that had been helpful, at least in the animal models, for diseases that caused shrinking brains, things like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig's disease, Huntington's disease. In 2007, I was still working, but I needed the tilt-reclined wheelchair. If I ever left my office, I could walk short distances to canes. I was losing my keys, my phone, my daily planner. And it was, in 1 month, I lost my phone 3 times. And that was when two very important things happened. One, I was introduced to neuromuscular electrical stimulation. And I had discovered functional medicine, which is an approach that really looks at the environmental factors that contribute to disease and works to optimize the environment as well as we can. At this point, I could not sit in a standard chair like you guys here. If I sat in any of these chairs that are out in the audience, I could do that for maybe 10 minutes, and then I'd be so exhausted I'd be requiring bed rest. I had a zero gravity chair like you see here. I had one at home and another one in my office at work. And that allowed me to continue working. And I was very, very grateful that the university had been as flexible as they had been in allowing me to have my job redesigned multiple times. And it was the summer then that I discovered neuromuscular stim, and I really discovered functional medicine. Now, many of us tend to believe that it's our genes that determine are we long-lived, healthy, can we live forever, or do we have to be, are there other factors? This article is by Professor Walter Willett, who's a Harvard professor, and he, in the article, Balancing Lifestyle and Genomics Research for Disease Prevention, he says, and let me quote, "We have been able to identify modifiable behavioral factors, including specific aspects of diet, overweight, inactivity, smoking, that account for over 70% of stroke and colon cancer, over 80% of heart disease, and over 90% of adult onset diabetes." And so what I'm going to talk with you about are a number of the environmental factors that will have a huge impact on the risk of the internal medicine type problems that I see in my primary care clinics: high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, mental health problems, arthritis. But they also have a huge impact on whether or not children will have an adequately developed upper jaw, lower jaw, so they have good teeth alignment, whether or not they have good mineralization of their teeth. And so these environmental factors will determine the probability that that child will end up with facial deformities, malaligned teeth, rotten carious teeth, or a great dental arch and strong, rigorous teeth. It will also determine whether or not they have chronic diseases. Now, the two environmental factors I'll really focus on today are the impact of diet and toxins. But other factors that are also very important are the hormonal balance, particularly how we manage our stress hormones, the kind of trauma, physical and psychological, that we must deal with, smoking exposures, and physical activity. Weston Price is a dentist who publishes work in nutrition and physical degeneration. And I recommend this book very highly to you and your patients. He took a multidisciplinary team around the globe to study 14 different indigenous peoples and examine the diet, what people were eating. They did soil analyses, nutritional analyses of the food, and they did a physical, dental, mental health exam, including a lot of photographs. They did an analysis by diet. Were the individuals eating the primitive traditional diet? Had they adopted a westernized diet? And had they had their parents eaten a primitive diet or a westernized diet? So you had a primitive diet group, a first generation Western diet group, and a second generation Western diet group. Now, that Western diet's very familiar. It's a lot of meat, white potatoes, white flour, sugar, and very few vegetables, very few greens, very few fruit. The primitive diet is actually quite variable depending on the locale. The Inuit or the Eskimos in the far north had a predominantly meat-based diet, fish diet, that was eaten raw with occasional aspects of food and berries. But the meat, fish, were consumed raw. If you get down into the Amazonian rainforest, the Aborigines, the Africans, everyone was eating a diet that was local, fresh, in season. And people who were not living near the coast would trade for seafoods, and those seafoods would be targeted towards the individuals who are trying to conceive. This is a picture of the dental health impact. And what you see, the primitive diet has straight, full teeth, great alignment. They're less than one per thousand in terms of cavities. The westernized diet is crooked, missing, rotten, carious teeth with attack rates as high as 80-85%. If you look at the medical side, the primitive diet was much more likely to have greater physical and mental health, greater physical fitness. And the westernized diet was more likely to have high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes. And when you looked at the vitamin, mineral, essential fat content, the primitive diet was actually very high, whereas, of course, the Western diet was relatively low in the water-soluble, fat-soluble vitamins, minerals, and essential fatty acids. And so there was much more chronic disease in the westernized diet. Dr. Price predicted that these primitive societies, as they were westernized, would have a rapid decline in health. And he also predicted that westernized societies would experience a continual decline in health. And this, of course, has happened. He made all these observations in the 1930s. I'm going to fast forward you here. This is some work done by Cordain, where he's using the national data on our food and nutrition intake that estimates the percent of Americans that their intake is below the recommended daily allowance for a particular nutrient. When you look at the bottom of this bar graph, you'll see a number of the B vitamins, and it ranges from 18-50% of Americans over the age of two fail to have an adequate intake of important B vitamins. And about half of us do not have enough intake for vitamin C. Then, if we move up to minerals, iron, magnesium, calcium, zinc, iodine, all of which are very important cofactors for numerous enzymes in the brain, in our immune system. And you'll see that between half and two-thirds of us fail to take in adequate minerals. And if we go up to omega-3 fats, it's 80% of us fail to take in the recommended daily allowance for fatty acids. So, as I was aware of the key links between nutrition, health, the environmental factors, and then wanting to design a diet that would ensure a great superior amount of vitamins, minerals, essential fatty acids, my research took me to the hunter-gatherer diet, also known as the Paleolithic diet. Dr. Lauren Cordain is one of the world's foremost researchers on this. And the concept is that people are eating what they could have been able to have eaten pre-dawn of agriculture, so greater than 10,000 years ago. And that was leaves, a lot of leaves, roots, fruits, meat, nuts, most of it raw, no grain, no dairy, and no legumes. And humans have been around for about 2 million years in our evolution. The 10,000 years since agriculture is a very short window. The diet, when you're eating in season, greens, roots, fruits, meats, nuts, as this has been studied in multiple settings, that local hunter-gatherer diet, Paleolithic diet, has 2 to 8 times the recommended daily allowance for water-soluble vitamins, minerals, and essential fatty acids. This is just a sample of some of the studies. that have looked at the Paleolithic diet versus the standard American diet. And consistently, there's more nutrients. There's minimal grain, no starch, no sugar, lots of vegetables, grass-fed wild meat. It's mostly raw. And it exceeds the recommended daily allowance 2 to 8 times. The kids and adults who eat that have straight teeth and very few caries, very few cavities, less chronic disease. And in prospective studies that have looked at the Paleolithic diet as the intervention, they see that within days, there is measurable improvement in blood lipids, blood cholesterol, markers of inflammation, and in weeks, measurable improvement in blood pressure and C-reactive proteins. It's also easier to lose weight with less hunger on this diet and has a superior blood sugar control as compared to the standard American diet, the American Heart Diet, or the American Diabetes Association diets. I'm going to walk you through next some of the nutrients that I know of that are required for optimal brain function. So I have about 1 billion brain cells and hopefully about 10 trillion connections between those brain cells. And all of that wiring needs to be insulated. Myelin is the insulation for the wiring. And some of the building blocks that are needed are thiamin, which is B1, cobalamin, B12, folate, B9, omega-3 fatty acids, iodine, and sulfur. And then for the neurotransmitters, you need also sulfur and pyridoxine or B6. And the brain is very dependent on having robust, healthy mitochondria. And I had to memorize all these chemical reactions for the mitochondria in medical school, which I did forget. And I assume in dental school, you have to memorize a lot of that chemistry as well. Unfortunately, we did not learn which of the nutrients we need to eat to see to it that our mitochondria would have optimal health. So the summary is B vitamins, sulfur, and antioxidants. So this comes out to a lot of greens, a lot of sulfur containing vegetables, and brightly colored fruits and vegetables. This is a picture of a beautiful smile. And what I want to point out to you is that Western Price and the Western Price Foundation and westernprice.org have continued his work on the nutritional aspects of optimal dental health. And what Dr. Price had observed in terms of the nutrients that he thought were required for optimal dental health were omega-3 fatty acids, activator X, which we now think might be vitamin K2, which he found in organ meat, vitamin D and A, also in organ meats, and lots of minerals, and stressing greens, raw and cooked, bone broth, and as I said earlier, organ meats. You can get more information about that at westernaprice.org. We have, at least on the medical side, an increasing awareness that gingivitis drives atherosclerosis. And so there's a growing body of research that is linking the bacteria that lives in my gum tissue and causes some chronic low-level inflammation around my teeth is also linked to a chronic inflammation in my coronary arteries and a higher risk of heart attack and heart disease. There is an ancient Indian tradition, Ayurvedic medicine, called oil pulling, where you take about a tablespoon of oil, such as olive oil, sesame oil, coconut oil, swish it in your mouth, work it through your teeth, 10 to 20 minutes, and then you spit it out into a waste receptacle and rinse the mouth out with salt water. And in this particular study, there was a definitive reduction in the S. mutans count on plaque and saliva after oil pulling therapy. Now, if anyone's going to try this, my advice is you start with a teaspoon of oil and you do this for just a minute and gradually, very gradually increase the length of time. There are a couple of books that I'd recommend very highly. They're out in the lay press, and I think you should be aware of those as hopefully your patients are beginning to look into some of these alternative strategies for improving their dental health. Oil Pulling Therapy by Bruce Fife and Cured Tooth Decay by Ramiel Nagel. In his book, he talks a lot about the Western price diet and pushing essential oils, mineral-rich foods, organ meats as a strategy to help people remineralize their teeth, even when some decay is present. Now, there are many studies in Canada, in Europe, and in America that have tried to quantify the amount of toxins that we are born with. And so they can do that either looking through the breast milk or through cord blood. And typically they look for between 400 and 500 different toxins. And I should remind you that the Environmental Protection Agency has about 90,000 different compounds registered as having toxic effects. But that would be too expensive for the research study, so we're just looking for 400 to 500. Consistently, between 200 and 300 are found. This is the list. And what you see is a combination of pesticides, herbicides, plastics, solvents, heavy metals, Teflon, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. We're born with that. And then we enter a world where chemicals have been used to replace human effort. And so we have an increasing exposure because of higher numbers of cars and automobiles on the roads, more coal-fired plants, more chemicals introduced every year. And your body will have to take those chemicals that you'll absorb through your indoor air environment, through the outdoor air, through the water, through the food, absorbed through the fireproofing on your clothing, through your personal care products. And it's in your liver and your kidney and your sweat glands that you will use a two-step process that we call phase one and phase two to take this fat-soluble toxic molecule that is confusing your biology, screwing you up, and converting it to a water-soluble molecule that you can excrete in your bile, urine, or sweat. And so having the appropriate building blocks for the enzymatic steps will make it either easier or more difficult for you to excrete these toxins. And if you can't get the toxins out, they will be parked in your fat. And since your brain is 60 to 70% fat, these toxins will be parked up in your brain, where they will slowly increase the inflammation and degeneration of the brain. So let me walk you through foods that you could eat to maximize your excretion of toxins. So for phase one, carotenoids, those are the orange things, carrots, squash, pumpkin, lycopene, that would be tomatoes, zeaxanthin, astaxanthin, that would be krill, anthocyanins, those are blackberries, black grapes, beets, ellagic acid, pomegranates, raspberries, strawberries, quercetin, would be green tea, yerba mate, and fruit and vegetable skin. And then on the phase two, it's the same list plus these things. Now you need some sulfur, so that would be the sulfur-containing vegetables in the allicin family, which would be onions, garlic, chives, leeks, shallots. The cruciferous family, which would be cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale, collards, mustard greens, watercress, wintercress, arugula, turnips, radishes, rutabagas. Montipurines, which would be citrus peel and cherries. Curcuminoids, which would be turmeric and ginger. And rosemary. Now, in addition, for the heavy metals, you need to have a robust supply of minerals, including iodine, zinc, selenium, and magnesium, to handle and excrete the heavy metals like lead, mercury, aluminum. So for that, I'd recommend powdered kelp, seaweed, algae, brewer's yeast, iodized sea salt. But my favorite would have to be things like organic kelp and organic algae to help you excrete the toxins. Food allergies are very hard to diagnose. My daughter made this graphic for me. With dairy and gluten, I shall conquer the world, Lord Voldemort. In case you didn't know that, he is the bad guy. And it's very difficult to diagnose gluten and dairy allergies. People can have symptoms for years to decades of fatigue, malaise, neurological and psychological symptoms before finally a diagnosis is made. It's estimated that 90% of those who have a gluten sensitivity will also have a dairy sensitivity and will have no GI symptoms of any type. There'll be no abdominal complaints whatsoever. This is just a sample of some of the articles that link gluten sensitivity and a brain disorder. So celiac disease as motor neuropathy, gluten ataxia, that's balance problems. We have a psychiatric problem, autism, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and epilepsy. So my counsel to people who have brain disorders is to go gluten-free, dairy-free for a couple weeks and see what happens. Ideally, do it for a month. And because the protein in dairy, and that's both goat and cow milk, is structurally has some overlap with the protein in gluten, that if you're sensitive to one, you're likely sensitive to both proteins. Therefore, I recommend staying away from both compounds. Therefore, no wheat, no rye, no barley. So Voldemort finally meets his match, Harry Potter, the boy who ate kale. Now, you may not know, but J.K. Rowling's mother died of multiple sclerosis as a very young woman in her 40s. I think it's quite possible that J.K. Rowling would be quite pleased to have Lord Voldemort represent the devastating disease of MS, and that it is through the power of intensive nutrition that we're able to beat back the ravages of that disease. So let me sort of summarize things. In October of 2007, I was losing my books, losing my phone, my keys. I could walk short distances, two canes. I could not sit in a standard chair. I began doing neuromuscular electrical stimulation of my muscles, and I began the Walls diet, which, well, I'll summarize for you, is 9 cups of vegetables and fruit, a plateful of green leaves, a plateful of sulfur-rich vegetables, and that would be cabbage family, onion family, mushrooms, and a plateful of bright colors, and that could be berries or vegetables, wild fish, wild game, grass-fed meat, kelp, and algae. And I structured this after the hunter-gatherer diet because I wanted to have the most vitamin, mineral, essential fatty acid content that I could per calorie. Within a year of making that change, I was able to do a bicycle ride, 18 miles, on the Courage Ride. I was tired at the end, but I was jubilant because I had not thought that would be possible. The following year, I was speaking in Canada and did a trail ride for an hour and a half up and down the mountain through the rivers. And again, I was tired at the end, but once again, jubilant that I was able to ride again. And in 2010, I began lecturing, doing food as medicine lectures about the healing power of kale. And in 2011, we have a funded clinical trial that's underway, and we have 9 subjects enrolled who are so far showing us that they can implement this very complicated regimen of 9 cups of vegetables. We teach them meditation. We teach self-massage. We also show them a stretching program, progressive exercise, and have them begin neuromuscular electrical stimulation at home. Now, if you'd like to learn more about what I do, I suggest you sign up for my newsletter, and you can do that, and I've got 2 of them, so sign up in both places, terrywalls.com, and also go to thewallsfoundation.com. Minding My Mitochondria, How I Overcame Secondary Progressive Multiple Sclerosis and Got Out of My Wheelchair, is available through Amazon, through New Pioneer, and through Prairie Lights. And this is your code, DRNW7951. Now, I know some of you had submitted some questions, so let me take those for you now. What do I think of mercury and MS? First, let me say, I do think mercury is definitely a problem. For some people, it is a much larger problem than others. It will depend if I have a single nucleotide polymorphism so that my enzymes that metabolize B vitamins that metabolize sulfur are less effective. I will become less effective at metabolizing mercury. And therefore, my mercury load from my mouth will be slowly shifted into my fat and brain. And there's plenty of literature that does show a strong association between the amount of mercury in my mouth and the amount of mercury in the brain. So I think it's far better for people to not have mercury in their mouths. Although I do respect that there are some cost constraints that people have to weigh. Mm-hmm. Now, what about fluoride? I'd mentioned to you that many Americans do not take in enough iodine. In the 1920s, the American government recognized that iodine was relatively low, in that by adding iodine to our salt, we increased our iodine intake and decreased the amount of goiter and iodine-related mental retardation. Then in the 1960s, physicians decided that salt was associated with high blood pressure, and we asked the American public to quit eating so much salt. We also began to put fluoride in the water, which competes with iodine. We put chlorine in the water, which competes with iodine. And we put bromine in the food, which competes with iodine. And the groundwater is sometimes contaminated with perchlorate, which also competes with iodine. And so our iodine requirements have gone steadily up, but the iodine intake has gone steadily down. As you become iodine insufficient, you're much more likely to have thyroid disease, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and you have much more difficulty handling mercury, heavy metals, and other toxins. My approach is to recommend that people take kelp, a kelp capsule every day, or a quarter teaspoon of organic kelp daily. The question about dosing for omega-3 in children, I'm not a pediatrician, so that's the first thing I need to be very clear. I'm not a pediatrician. I can only tell you what I did with my kids. When they were 5, I found a 500 milligram capsule and got them to take that every day. When they got to be seven, I took that to two capsules. When they got to be 12, I had them taking 2 grams of fish oil every day. Now, notably, my kids, you know, actually, I think they started that when they were 10 and 8. And my kids were originally told that they're going to need a lot of braces and headgear. And my son started his fish oil. He had one band put on. He only needed it for a few months. And they said, well, they'd bring him back in a couple years and they'd get him fit for the headgear. But when he came back, his tooth alignment was perfect, other than having perhaps a bit of a gap between his front teeth. And likewise, my daughter's jaws also grew more appropriately, and her alignment was perfectly fine. And there's plenty of information that omega-3 intake really impacts the development of your upper jaw, lower jaw, and therefore also your frontal lobes on executive decision-making. So I think something that you could do for on a public health basis for our kids is to stress to parents the importance of omega-3 dosing for kids for healthy brain development, healthy jaw development, plenty of space for their teeth. Let me expand a bit more on the nutritional healing for tooth decay. The standard American diet, which is very low in minerals, high in white flour and sugar, certainly promotes tooth decay. Switching to a paleolithic diet, increasing some organ meat and essential oils certainly improves mineralization and lowers the risk of tooth decay. And you may want to check out the Cured Tooth Decay book for more information. So let me summarize sort of the key concepts again for everyone. It's 9 cups of vegetables and fruit, a plate full of green leaves, a plate full of sulfur vegetables, a plate full of color, and meat of your choice. Prefer raw or steamed, fried to lose some of the nutrients. If you're not large enough to eat 9 cups of vegetables and fruit, just do proportionately what you can. Although I would think that the green leaves are probably the most important. Again, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening in to Dr. Terry Walls.